So I'd like to start by briefly considering what's become the traditional outline of the Stoic ontological scheme. The Stoics, our sources tell us, hold that only bodies exist, and bodies, by Chrysippus' time at least, are subject to analysis under each of four genera. What makes a body what it is are the qualities it has in virtue of the pneuma that runs through it, the pneuma being composed from the elements of fire and air, which have centrifugal and centripetal motions respectively. It's the tension between these two forces that holds the individual body together as a unified thing. And the specific degree of tension unique to an individual is what determines the individual body's unique particular quality. Whilst bodies and their qualitative structures take pride of place in the Stoic worldview, existence is not the only mode of reality. And the Stoics recognize a higher genus, T, or something, that sits above body and includes a second class of real entities, the incorporeals, which are non-existent but real somethings. Amongst the incorporeals are, at least, time, void, place, and lecter, or sayables, which are something a bit like propositions. This provides us with a basic framework for understanding Stoic ontology that is, to my knowledge, universally accepted by scholars working on the topic today. And I've tried to present this in the stemmer in number one on your handout. This is taken from Long and Sedley's The Hellenistic Philosophers, and somewhat adapted to remove all the controversial suggestions that they add, which are fairly limited. Long and Sedley suggest that in addition to there being bodies and incorporeals, there's then a third class of entity that are neither corporeal nor incorporeal, and they locate limits and fictional entities under that heading. There are quite a few other controversies. There's been a very lively and stimulating debate over the years about the status of universals in Stoicism. The traditional view developed by Sedley and Brunschvig identifies universals as not somethings and as falling entirely outside the structure of the ontological scheme. They're not somethings because they lack particularity. So the defining feature of something is particularity. Victor Caston more recently has argued that actually Stoic ontology is comprehensive and coherent, and that we should try and find a way to bring universals back into the scheme. He's pretty cagey about where in the scheme he would put them, though. Other issues that have been lively topics recently are where we put limits. I've mentioned that Long and Sedley put them under a third class of something, neither body nor incorporeal. Jacques Brunschvig suggests that they should be considered to be not somethings. He suggests that they're not particulars because they are shared between the entities that limits are between. And I and a number of other people have argued that they're actually incorporeals because that's what the sources say they are. So there are a range of debates going on about Stoic ontology, but what we have here is the stuff that's not debated. It's accepted that there are at least two classes of something, body and incorporeal. There are at least four incorporeals, sayables, void, place, time, and that body is divided, well, that bodies can be analysed under each of four different genera: substrate, qualified, disposed, and relatively disposed. So this should be fairly uncontroversial. What I'd like to do today is to suggest that it shouldn't be, and in particular to argue that the right-hand side of this stemma, the category of body, needs to be complicated a bit. I want to argue that there are actually several different types of body for the Stoics, and that we need to break up this single category, because acting as if there is only one type of body, we become unable to deal with a number of problematic types of entity in Stoicism. In particular, I'm going to talk about composite bodies today. So, the central distinction to which I want to draw attention is that between complete and incomplete bodies, or more precisely, between the many incomplete bodies of the subcosmic realm and the single complete body that is the whole to which they all belong as parts, the cosmos itself. Plutarch reports, this is number two on the handout, Chrysippus as holding that the world is a complete body, but the parts of the world are not complete because they are disposed in certain ways relative to the whole and are not per se, not cath outer. Whilst the incomplete subcosmic bodies are relatively disposed to something external, that is, the whole of which they are parts, the cosmos, by contrast, is not, for there is no greater whole to which the cosmos belongs. Indeed, there's nothing at all outside it to which it stands in any structured relationship. Now, the Stoics do acknowledge a void outside the cosmos, but they deny that the cosmos and void together form an orderly whole. Rather, they form a mere collection, which the Stoics term the all, and which they say is atakton, or lacking in order and indeterminate. Relevant passages there are at 3a and 3b. Whilst the first three genera of the Stoic four genera theory, substrate, qualified, and disposed, provide the Stoics with ways of analysing the internal structures of a body, the fourth genus, prosti prosekon, or relatively disposed, allows bodies to be analysed in terms of their relationships to external objects. But given that the cosmos is unique in not standing in any determinate relationship to anything external, we can quickly see that the four genera theory does not apply in full to this special type of body. Cicero provides us with some further information about what it means to be complete. Now, this is number four on the handout. It's not just that the cosmos is physically complete, containing all bodies, but it's also teleologically complete. The cosmos is not for the sake of anything other than itself. Subcosmic bodies, by contrast, are all for the sake of other things, both other subcosmic bodies and, ultimately, for the providentially ordered structure of the world. The teleological and physical incompleteness of the subcosmic bodies has an important epistemological consequence. In order to fully comprehend a subcosmic body, it's not enough to know everything there is to know about its internal structure. Rather, one must also know how it fits into the broader cosmic order of which it forms a part. Which is to say, one must know how it is relatively disposed to externals, and this is precisely the point of that fourth genus. When we consider the cosmos, by contrast, knowledge of its internal structure is sufficient for full comprehension, because everything is included within it. There's an important sense, then, in which to treat a subcosmic body as a distinct entity, to treat it as something separate or independently real, is to fail to fully understand it. Indeed, Stoic physics is adamant that there are no truly distinct subcosmic bodies. The world is a single, unified physical continuum with no gaps between its parts. And an important aspect of one's philosophical development is coming to the realization that the apparent separation of subcosmic bodies from each other is simply a consequence of the limited microcosmic human perspective on the world. The realization that all apparently distinct physical bodies are in fact seamless parts of a greater providentially ordered whole is a vital step in moving towards the ethical end of a life in agreement with nature, which requires that one take on the divine macrocosmic perspective and abandon the view that subcosmic bodies are independent of one another. Epictetus makes this point particularly clearly. He points out that if a foot is taken to be something absolute, apolutos, a term which Simplicius uses as a synonym for cath outer in his report of Stoic thought on relativity, then one might think that it is unnatural for it to be damaged or dirtied. But this is not really to treat it as a foot, since a foot just is part of a greater whole. He writes, "Yet if you take it as a foot and not as something absolute, it will be appropriate for it to step into mud and trample on thorns and sometimes to be amputated for the sake of the whole. Otherwise, it will no longer be a foot." Similarly, in the case of humans, if you view yourself as something absolute, it's natural for you to live to old age to be wealthy and healthy. But if you view yourself as a human being and a part of some whole, for the sake of that whole, it's appropriate for you to now to be sick, now to set sail and take risks, now to be in need, and maybe even die before your time. So this is a fundamental part of Stoic ethics. We overcome various attachments to things in the world by realizing that from the cosmic perspective, they are inconsequential, and that things that might appear to be negative from the merely human microcosmic perspective disappear when you take the divine macrocosmic perspective, and you understand that actually what appeared to be the tragic death of your child is part of the providentially ordered plan. all the bad things that appear to happen are actually good things because everything in the world is good. Now, the fact that the Stoics claim the cosmos is an undivided physical continuum and insist that we must adopt a macrocosmic perspective that avoids seeing individual parts of the world as truly independent entities will not be any sort of news to those with any interest in Stoicism. Indeed, I suspect it's just because it's such a basic feature of Stoic thought that the distinction between the complete cosmic body and the incomplete bodies of the subcosmic realm has been overlooked in attempts to map out the Stoic ontological scheme. Very well, we might say. The standard stemma should be amended to distinguish between these two types of bodies, but we already knew this, really. And changing the map very slightly doesn't really change our understanding of Stoic metaphysics itself. However, I think there is rather more to be gained from precision on this front, as the elision of these two types of bodies has obscured a number of interesting features of the Stoic scheme, and explicitly separating them out again holds out the possibility of resolving problems that have thus far been glossed over in the literature. So in the abstract for this paper, I mentioned that I talk about a couple of different problems, including relativity and composites. I decided in the end to confine myself to just one of these composites because I thought that was a more realistic project for a one-hour talk. But you can probably work out much of what I'd want to say about relativity and relationships from what I do have to say about composites. Composites, I think, are a special case of relational complex. So the particular problem I want to discuss today is the status of composite objects in Stoicism. Bodies for the Stoics are typically held to be unified particulars that acquire their unity and identity through being held together by the tension in their pneuma. Composites, though, have no sustaining pneuma to unify them, and thus would seem to fail to be bodies, and worse, fail even to be particular somethings. However, if composites are neither bodies nor any other type of something, then we should expect them not to be real things at all. And if they lack reality, it will be impossible to think and speak meaningfully about them. A basic premise in Stoic epistemology is that we can only think and speak meaningfully about the real things in the world, which is why they deny that we can actually talk about universals. They say when we speak about a universal, it only becomes meaningful if we reduce our talk about the universal to talk about specific token particulars. So if we say man is a rational mortal animal, that's meaningless because it has no referent in the world. There is no such thing as man. It only becomes meaningful when we turn it into a phrase such as, if something is a man, that thing is a rational mortal animal. So if we deny that composites are something, then we take them altogether outside of the realm of reality. And if that's the case, then we can't think or even speak about them in a meaningful way. Now, it might be tempting to simply deny that composites are real objects. If there are no non-qualitative particulars in the world, then the Stoics might claim that a thought of a composite has a non-real mental construct as its object, and that insofar as we can legitimately talk about composites, our statements must be reduced to statements about the component qualitative particulars of which it's constructed. Such an account would run in parallel with the Stoic treatment of universals, and would probably have to accommodate composites under the heading of not-somethings as some kind of mental construct. However, whilst an interpretation of this sort is superficially attractive, it must be rejected, I think. The theoretical consequences of this kind of position would burden the Stoics with a monstrous epistemological account of complex structures. The commander surveying his opponent's distant forces would be unable to think or speak truly about the hostile army unless he could perceive and describe individual component soldiers and their interactions with each other. Similarly, one's thought about a ship with its oars out runs the risk of quickly sinking under an unmanageable weight of detail, as it will ultimately have to comprehend and be reducible to thousands of nails, planks, spars, sails, and ropes, not to mention the relations in which each of these stands to each of the others. And even if the interrelated collection of parts could be held together in thought, it would not be possible to predicate anything of it as a collection without conceding that there is in fact some one thing there to be spoken of. So it is, I think, preferable to seek an account of composites that retains their reality and thus the ability to rationally cognize them as wholes. And such an account is, I think, available to us if we pay attention to the distinction between complete and incomplete bodies I identified in the first part of the paper. The most important evidence for Stoic thought on composites is found in a passage of Simplicius' commentary on Aristotle's Categories. This is number 6 on your handout. At 214.24-37, Simplicius reports that the Stoics describe qualities as havables, hekta, and allow what is havable to exist only in the case of unified things. Unified things are unified by their qualitative pneumatic tension, and are distinguished on this basis from two types of composite entities. Those composites that exist by contact amongst their constituent parts, such as ships, and those that exist with separated parts, such as armies. In neither of these types is there any single thing containing a single principle, a single logos, or a tenor. And as such, in neither case is there anything havable. However, whilst composites do not have qualities, they are said to be enduringly differentiated, and they do fall under a broader Stoic use of the term qualified. For the qualified, we're told, is seen even in things whose constituents are in contact or separated. While Simplicius is our only source for the labelling of composites as qualified, the distinction between unified and composite things was of considerable importance for the Stoics and is well attested elsewhere. The types of entity that appear in Simplicius's account are referred to in a number of other sources, and the distinctions were fully integrated with broader Stoic thought, as can be seen in the insistence that ethical goods are unified rather than composite entities. This is, then, a distinction that's fully theorised and bound into Stoic philosophy as a whole. It's sometimes been suggested that the theory is late and belongs to the Posidonian phase of the Stoa, but the outlines go back at least to Chrysippus, as Plutarch attests, and the evidence for that's at number 7 on the handout. Additional information about the nature of composites is added by a number of other sources. At least some Stoics made a further distinction amongst things that exist with separate parts. Some, such as choruses, have a definite number of parts, whilst others, such as armies or crowds, have an indefinite number. This demonstrates a Stoic interest in the numerosity of composites, and I will argue, if time permits, I've got a kind of coda for this paper, depending on how long I run, that there are very good theoretical reasons for the Stoics to reflect on this issue, and that this distinction helps shed light on the reasons for the distinction between composites and unified bodies. Sextus Empiricus provides important further details that help to flesh out how the internal structure of a composite should and should not be conceived. Unified entities, he reports, exhibit a structural sympathy, sympatheia. The initial examples he gives show sympathy between parts. Animals wax and wane in sympathy with the moon, as do tides. And this is because all are parts of a single unified whole, the cosmos. Similarly, the movements of the stars accord with alterations in the state of the air, sometimes bringing healthy environments and sometimes disease-ridden ones. From these facts, the argument runs, it's obvious that the cosmos is a unified body. In the case of composites, on the other hand, we're told the parts do not sympathise with one another. A single surviving soldier is said not to suffer at all from the death of the rest of the army. But in the case of a unified body, when the finger is cut, the whole body shares in this condition. We would say the person has been cut. There are numerous reasons to think that the Stoics want composites to be real things, despite distinguishing them from qualitatively unified bodies. Simplicius's evidence, as we've seen, tells us that despite denying that composites have qualities, the Stoics do allow that they can be called qualified in a broader sense of the term, which not only associates them with unified bodies, but also holds out the possibility that they might be subject to analysis under the four genera. It's striking that composites are allowed this designation when it's explicitly denied to universals, which only appear as if they are qualified. The fact that composites are enduringly differentiated is also suggestive, for it's hard to see how they could share this characteristic with unified bodies if they were treated as unreal. Most important are the grounds Simplicius gives for composites being called qualified. They're qualified on account of their organisation and their cooperation towards the fulfilment of a single function, which is to say, they're qualified because they are ordered structures. David Sedley, in his chapter on Stoic metaphysics in the Cambridge History of Hellenistic Philosophy, has denied that composites can be wholes. And this view, I suspect, has been an important contributory factor in the lack of interest scholars have shown in these entities. As far as I'm aware, there has been no treatment at all of composites in Stoicism, despite there being quite a few texts on the subject. At best, they will get a footnote in a treatment of Stoic ontology, whereas it seems to me that they're quite important entities that we need to accommodate. So Sedley denies that composites can be wholes, and a consequence of this is that they're not then significantly real entities. He suggests that the Stoic distinction between the whole and the all, which we saw in 3a and 3b, provides a useful analogy for the distinction between real qualitative wholes and composites. The all is just a collection of things, not a structured or orderly unit, and it lacks pneumatic tension. As the Stoics deny that this can be a whole, so Sedley thinks we should understand that neither can composites be wholes. Composites, thus, are mere collections, unstructured collections. However, while the whole-all distinction is certainly important, the idea of a direct analogy between the all and composites is misguided. Simplicius's testimony tells us that the parts of qualitative units are unified by their pneumatic tension, whilst those of composites are unified by their organisation and function. There is scope for a third type of relation between parts, such as applies when the parts are not unified at all, and it's this relation that applies to the all. Whilst composites are qualified on account of their organisation, their catataxis, the all is said to be atacton, and it's precisely because it lacks order and is indeterminate that it cannot be a whole. Indeed, it's striking that neither Plutarch nor Sextus Empiricus draw on the idea of the sustaining cause in reporting the Stoic distinction between the whole and the all. Indeed, Sextus relies on the all's lack of limits, and Plutarch associates this lack with indefiniteness. Most striking of all is Plutarch's explicit statement that whole is predicated of what is ordered. For if order, rather than pneumatic tension, is the criterion for being a real whole, then the composites, which are qualified on account of their organisation, must clearly be wholes, and thus real somethings. The evidence for Stoic thought about the all does not, then, exclude composites from the class of wholes. Rather, it provides strong evidence for their inclusion. That Sextus understood the Stoics as treating composites as wholes is confirmed against the mathematicians 9.338, which I'm afraid isn't on your handout, where ships are included on a list of wholes in a context that suggests this inclusion must have been acceptable to the Stoics. Plutarch, in a passage to which I'll return, provides a similar list, which suggests that Sextus and Plutarch are both drawing on a common Stoic source or tradition. What they both do is they provide a list of wholes that starts with a list of three unified examples of wholes, and then provides some composite examples. One particular type of composite that appears on these lists provides additional good reasons for treating composites as real. Seneca, in identifying cities and armies as composites, tells us that they are unified by law and function, with law being, I take it, the specific type of organisation relevant to social bodies. And there are a number of other passages in which cities are said to serve as an analogy for the cosmos as a whole. What I want to suggest is that whilst composites lack the paradigmatic type of unity found in tensionally sustained bodies, they do have an analogous type of unity that is sufficient to account for their reality, and the analogy is close enough for this more limited type of unity to be used to illustrate cases of tensionally sustained unity. A fragment of Arius Didymus preserved in Eusebius, this number 8 on the handout, helps to show that there's a direct parallel between tensional structure and composite structure. The world is also called the habitation of gods and men, and the structure consisting of gods and men, and the things created for their sake. For just as there are two meanings of city, one as a habitation and two as the structure of its inhabitants along with its citizens, so the world is like a city consisting of gods and men, with the gods serving as rulers and men as their subjects. Both the city and the cosmos are orderly structures, and this helps make clear that there is not just one type of real structure in the world, the tensionally sustained unit, but rather that bodies that are unified in virtue of their pneuma are just one type of body. Now, the passages that that discuss the structure of cities involve a further complication, because the Stoics make a distinction between true communities and base communities. Normal or base cities, they say, lack perfect harmony and agreement amongst their parts and fall short of the ideal of a city. In the human realm, such concord is found, we are to be told, only amongst the wise. And we should probably understand that the community of the wise counts as a tensionally unified structure. Like the cosmic city, whilst other communities do not, because they fall short of the necessary degree of internal cohesion. But this does not mean that base cities and communities lack reality. Stobaeus acknowledges that there are certain other kinds of association and bonding between the base, which are held together from the outside by necessity and opinion. That's probably number 10 on the hand. We know from Seneca that law and function are unifying factors, even amongst base composite communities. And Simplicius tells us that composites are enduringly differentiated on account of their organisation and cooperation towards the fulfilment of a single function. How, though, should we understand these factors as holding composites together from the outside by necessity and opinions? Before moving on to ask exactly how we should do this, I'll quickly finish surveying the evidence that suggests that composites should be treated as bodies, and then go on to note some possible objections to this view. One of the strongest reasons for thinking that composites constitute a distinct class of bodies is just that our evidence refers to them as bodies in a number of places. Sextus, for instance, in Recounting a Stoic Proof for the Existence of God's right, of God, writes that of bodies, some are unified, some are conjoined composites, and others are composites formed of separate things. Likewise, Plutarch asks, do we not in this world of ours often have one body composed of separate bodies, as Chrysippus believes? Plutarch is attacking the Stoic view that there can't be many worlds, since this would lead to a proliferation of things that the Stoics take as unique, such as God and providence. Plutarch takes Chrysippus's view and asks why, if composites can be composed of distinct entities on the basis of their organisation, can a plurality of worlds not exist, living under one logos and organised under one principle? The answer to Plutarch's objection is simply that the Stoics deny that there is a single logos in the case of a composite, despite it having a certain type of unity. Plutarch's point relies on a mistaken conflation of unitary organisation with the having of a single sustaining principle. Despite this, there seems little reason to doubt that the description of composites as bodies is authentically Chrysippian. That the position is not foisted upon the Stoa for polemical purposes here can be seen by the fact that Plutarch continues to treat composites as bodies elsewhere when making positive use of the Stoic theory. Evidence linking composites to the four genera theory also helps support the notion that they must be bodies. It's in the context of this theory that Simplicius identifies composites as qualified things which lack a quality. Additional evidence for the applicability of the four genera analysis of bodies to composites is provided by Plutarch's claim at number 11 on the handout, that since we should say that Pentheus missees when he perceives two suns and a double Thebes, we should also say that the Stoics misthink when they propose that not one city, but all men, animals, trees, furniture, implements and clothes are double and two-natured. Plutarch is criticising the idea that things can be analysed as both substrate and qualified. He's reducing, for the purposes of his argument, the four-genera theory to just two genera here. The examples are telling, for this is not a random mixture of six things such as might be picked out by Plutarch in seeking his own examples for the Stoic theory. Rather, the examples fall neatly into two groups. The first three, men, animals and trees, are all unquestionably types of unified body, with their own sustaining tension. The second group, furniture, implements and clothes, on the other hand, should probably be understood as composites. Certainly most furniture, implements and clothes are assemblies of conjoined parts, and independent confirmation that the Stoics treated furniture as composite can be found in some passages of Galen. The idea that composites are meant to be included as wholes here is further supported by the use of cities as the primary example, and we know for certain that cities are composites for the Stoics. Plutarch's list can usefully be compared to that provided by Sextus, which I mentioned a moment ago. Only four examples appear in Sextus's list of wholes, but the first three are very close to those on Plutarch's list. Where Plutarch gives men, animals and trees, Sextus gives men, horses and plants. So specific examples of animals and trees. And then he adds to these a clear example from the class of composite ships. So I suspect that Plutarch and Sextus are both drawing on a tradition in Stoicism, or a standard list that was given by somebody like Chrysippus that would give three types of unified entities and then some examples of composite entities when listing types of wholes. Compelling as this evidence may be, we must also consider some of the major difficulties for the claim that composites are bodily particulars. One major issue is that the Stoics define body in a way that might reasonably be thought to exclude composites. The definition of body as that which is able to act or be acted upon can be assimilated to the notion of composite bodies fairly easily. We can easily say that a ship acts or is acted upon. However, there's a second Stoic definition of body, which is that which is extended in three dimensions with resistance. And this is explicitly a definition of solid body. Now, composites that exist by contact amongst their parts can be understood with a little work as meeting this definition. But composites that have separated parts, such as armies or choruses, can hardly be said to be solids. The issue might be diffused somewhat by de-emphasising solidity in the whole and claiming that resistance can be found in the solidity of the parts, but I don't think this is a particularly satisfying solution. In addition, a range of our evidence for Stoicism suggests that all bodies must have sustaining causes. And this evidence has shaped the scholarly debate to the extent that it's normally simply assumed that bodies just are tensionally sustained. There is no point belabouring this evidence, but to give a few examples, Galen in his work on containing causes criticises the view that no body can exist without a sustaining cause. It seems very likely that these comments are aimed at the Stoics. Another interesting passage is a little later in Simplicius, after the passage on the handout, in which he reports that the Stoics held there to be a common account of explanation for bodies and incorporeals alike. And this account is presented explicitly in terms of qualitative causes, with the quality here being associated directly with pneuma, leaving us little room to argue that it's shorthand for a broader sense of qualified which could include the composites. This would then appear to deny not just that composites can be bodies, but that they can be any sort of something at all. Stoic thought on Hector or habibles raises another potential problem. In Simplicius's account of composites, the Stoics are said to allow Hector to exist only in the case of qualitatively unified objects, denying that there is anything habitable in composites. A problem arises when this report is placed alongside the more detailed discussion of Hector a little earlier, at 209.10-29. For the Stoic Antipater is there said to have made the hecton the coincidental characteristic common to bodies and incorporeals alike, i.e. that which is shared by all particular somethings. Now, if the Stoics denied that there was anything habitable in composites, while also accepting that Hector are found in all somethings, then this would again seem to rule out the possibility that composites can be somethings. That last issue, I think, can be solved in isolation by arguing that Antipater's view is unorthodox and doesn't represent the standard Stoic line. It represents a later extreme development of their theory of Hector. But I'm not going to seek to go down that route today. Rather, I'll suggest that all these objections can be circumvented by one simple move. In the first part of the paper, I emphasised the importance of the distinction between complete and incomplete bodies, and the need to include this distinction in any account of the Stoic ontological scheme. The cosmos itself is the only complete body, being entirely self-sufficient and neither dependent upon nor relatively disposed to any external object. The cosmos is a perfect unitary whole, both metaphysically and epistemologically complete. The incomplete partial wholes that populate the world of human experience are, by contrast, a second derivative type of particular body. They may appear to be absolute units, but this is not really the case. They're actually embedded in a complex network of relative dispositions towards the other parts of the cosmos, and they can neither exist nor be known fully apart from this context. But they are particular units insofar as they are microcosms of the cosmic continuum, being internally unified and held together by a rational sustaining principle, despite their metaphysical and epistemological dependence on the other things in the world. Composites, on the other hand, are subcosmic structures that are composed from a plurality of these particular unitary subcosmic bodies, and are not, when viewed from the microcosmic perspective, held together and sustained internally by a single principle. So that's the major problem, that when we view composites from the microcosmic perspective, they have nothing that holds them together. However, when a composite complex is viewed from the divine macrocosmic perspective and seen as an ordered structure within the tensionally unified cosmos, it becomes impossible to claim any longer that its parts are not held together in any way by a sustaining principle. They may not be held together from the inside in the same way as is a tensional subcosmic body, but there are external forces that ground the reality of such complexes. The orderly arrangement of a composite is a feature of the tensional structure of the world, and this feature can be circumscribed by the mind and legitimately treated as a real object, even if it is not, in the fullest sense, an internally cohesive unit, when viewed from the more limited human perspective, which we should, in any case, seek to abandon. This, I think, explains Tobias's acknowledgement that, in addition to the perfectly harmonious unity of the community of the wise, there are certain other kinds of association and bonding which are held together from the outside by necessity and opinions. The presence of opinion here tells us that the human mind plays some sort of role in making composites what they are. At the same time, the fact that composites are also held together by necessity confirms that they're not purely arbitrary mental constructs. Composites correspond to real structures within the cosmos that are not tensionally unified at the microcosmic level, but which are dispositions of the unified cosmos. Composite structures can be recognized by the human mind, but in doing so, the human treats them as distinct units. Mapping the contours of their structure with boundaries that are conceived of in microcosmic terms, but that are really only found at the macrocosmic level. When this perspective is adopted, the apparent difficulties the Stoics have with composites disappear. The Stoics can maintain the hard line that tensional structure is criterial for bodies, without being forced to deny that composites are real, by locating the tensional structure at the level of the cosmic body, and the multiple parts of the composite at the subcosmic level. From the macrocosmic perspective, we can understand composites as temporary dispositions of the cosmic whole. So, for example, the cosmos having some of its parts arranged such that there is, for a time, a ship within it. It's this status that guarantees the reality of composites. A subcosmic composite will then be a genuine unitary body as a disposition of the cosmos and will be tensionally sustained at this higher level. If this understanding is correct, then we should treat composites as a second type of incomplete particular, which draws on the unified bodies of the microcosmic realm for its parts and on the cosmic pneuma for its cohesion. Understanding composites in this way has the virtue of resolving a number of difficulties. By taking composites to be dispositions of the cosmic pneuma, we're able to provide a metaphysical grounding for meaningful thought and speech about such objects. As the common conceptions of objects that are formed from juxtaposed parts and the need to form propositions about composites demand that we should. At the same time, the two different perspectives on composites will help explain some of the apparent contradictions in our sources. We can say A, that only bodies exist, B, that all bodies are tensionally sustained, yet C, composites are real, whilst D, composites are not tensionally sustained, by noting that D is only true in a restricted microcosmic sense, and that the fuller macrocosmic perspective will show that composites are indeed what they are in virtue of the broader pneumatic structure within which they are embedded. A similar move will allow us to deal with the difficulty raised for composites composed from separate parts by the requirement that bodies should be solid. When viewed from the microcosmic perspective, the parts of a composite are distinct. But when we view them as a disposition of the cosmos as a whole, they form parts of a unified physical continuum. Just as Socrates so disposed that his hands are 2 inches apart is no less solid in virtue of the lack of local continuity between his hands, so the cosmos disposed in such a way that certain parts of it are related such as to form an army is no less solid in virtue of the lack of local continuity between the soldiers. For both the hands and the soldiers, it doesn't matter that they are physically separated from one another, because in both cases they are intrinsic parts of a larger, solid and cohesive whole. Composites can then be understood as both bodies and somethings, so long as we approach them in the correct manner. If we return now to the right-hand side of our ontological stemma, we can see that body subject to analysis under the four genera is clearly not enough to capture the details of the Stoic system. At the least, we can identify three different types of body: the complete cosmic body, incomplete internally unified bodies, and incomplete composite bodies.